Do you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Elder Talk. Well, as promised, our last show, we were talking about Medicaid, and we said we would carry that discussion on to today. Medicaid, again, to give a little bit of a synopsis of why we take the time to talk about this, you know, for people who know that there's a significant probability that there's going to be some period of time in which they may have to have some sort of institutional care. I hate to use that phrase.
Yeah, not a fun word.
Yeah, where they might be in some sort of facility. Now, incidentally, that means that, Susan, that's a whole lot better today than if we were having this conversation 30 years ago.
Oh, yes. There have been big changes.
Yeah, and some very nice facilities, let me say. I mean, the ones that I've been in associated with clients and family, I can tell you that for the most part, I've been very impressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I've even said to my wife, I've said, Yvonne, that you know, it's not so bad if we end up at a time in our life. I mean, now they're even luxurious. And I'm not talking about the most expensive. I am talking about clearly probably the upper third in terms of quality. But I'm sure all of these places have Medicaid beds.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, what I have seen when I've toured some of them is they have much more focus on the individual. They have communities. They have concepts that are very helpful and welcoming to the community, letting you still have family interaction, have your Christmas dinner together. I mean, all of those things are just much more welcoming and much more inviting.
Home-like.
Yes, home-like.
And I think that's what they're trying to achieve. I think that the whole idea about the room now is not to be treated like a hospital room. It's to be treated like the space in which you live, like your little apartment of one room.
Mm-hmm.
And then the common areas are kind of an extension of that.
Right. Activities every single day.
And you're supposed to own your room.
Right. I mean, hair salons are there.
By own, I mean, you know, you're encouraged to decorate it. You use your own furniture if you choose, and many people do. But you're right. They try to create an environment that is very social, et cetera. It is. It's a much better thing than it was at one time. So I think many people who may not have been in a nursing home in 30, 40 years, maybe the last time they were in was, you know, perhaps when their grandmother was aging decades ago,
mm-hmm.
They should check them out now. I think that they'll be pleasantly surprised. But still, there is the issue of paying for these things.
Mm-hmm.
So many people know that, yeah, if they have the ability, they can pull out their checkbook and they can write, or their debit card, they can pull out their debit card and spend $10,000 a month and have, you know, all the benefits we've described. But for some people, that is either not realistic, because if they were to be, for example, 36 months, which is not uncommon, that would sink their financial plans their children, their estate planning, et cetera, maybe impact a surviving spouse, et cetera. So for some people, they just figure we need another plan. Now, the good news, for what it's worth, is that if you are broke, you do qualify for Medicaid.
Automatically.
But I can tell you that's a harsh definition. We've talked about on here before some of these fundamental elements. Let me review them here quickly. If you look at just the official definition, in Missouri now is that if you're single, you can have $3,000 in assets, or if you're married, $6,000. And then you have some exemptions. An exemption would include a house with up to, say, in the ballpark of $550,000 equity. Most people are safe there. You can have a car. You can have personal effects, furniture, things such as that. Those you're allowed to own and keep. But as we talked in the last show, exempt doesn't mean the same thing as fully protected.
Right.
What it means is merely that it's postponed, that ultimately the house can be taken from you. And as far as the state of Missouri, the Attorney General's office is concerned, it will be taken at some point, whether it's after you die or after your surviving spouse dies.
So it's not that the nursing home or the facility is not going to get payment or just get what Medicaid has. It's just delayed.
It's delayed. And in fairness, they don't take the entire equity of the house. They only take the amount to repay the benefits you received. But still, it's a bit of a hollow victory for you to go into a nursing home knowing that your house is sitting out there, presumably occupied by your surviving spouse, but knowing that ultimately it's going to be sold to pay for your care. So most people figure it's going to be a problem qualifying according to the official rules for Medicaid, and they would like to do some Medicaid planning that might allow them to qualify and still preserve some assets for their loved ones. But now, as we talked the other day, all too often, Medicaid planners, lawyers who work in this area, elder lawyers, I think sometimes make the mistake that tax lawyers make and that tax accountants make.
Mm-hmm.
And it can easily be that, for example, we all know that tax accountants figure the most important thing for you to do, tax lawyers the same thing, is to avoid taxes. Now, if you go into representing a client with that hierarchy of priorities, then you can very well end up with a tail that's wagging the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And that is often what happens. And a good example of that is what happens with people's deferred assets, the ones that have not been taxed through 401k, IRAs, et cetera, and yet they know that as they take it out, they'll ultimately pay taxes on those. And so accountants regard it as just apparent that you wouldn't want to take that out unless you absolutely, absolutely have to. And instead, I suggest that people think about their higher priorities in life. And maybe their higher priorities in life might have been that when they made the decision at age 25 to start contributing to a 401k or an IRA, and as they continue to do that through the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and now they're in their 70s, their intention had been, at least in the early decades, to enjoy the wonderful benefits of tax deferral, which have allowed them to accumulate a much larger amount of money than they otherwise could. It's amazing the mathematical effect mm-hmm. of letting those dollars accrue interest.
Starting early.
Yeah, that you would have paid the IRS, and starting early. But somewhere along the way, they forget that the reason they did that was to have a pot of money that was going to make their lives much better when they're older, that they were going to enjoy it. They envision themselves, I'm sure, not huddled in a house with a thermostat set low and with canceling subscriptions to newspapers and trying to avoid touching that money. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the plan, but somewhere along the way it became the plan. And I'm suggesting that and I've said this to many clients, I've even said it to you listening in the past, and that's that, you know, you need to make clear your priorities, whether it's tax attorneys or Medicaid planners. Medicaid planners, in the same way, can easily lose sight of what might be an overriding priority. A Medicaid planner, often, again, it's an elder lawyer typically, certified financial planners, and some others do this, some CPAs. But they can easily just take it as a given that the primary overriding consideration is to pay as little as possible for your long-term care. And for many attorneys, it's easy to fall into the trap of not even questioning that.
Mm-hmm.
And the client is sort of led along. It does sound reasonable to the
sure.
client, but I think that the client should instead be probed, should be asked by their professional, whether it's a CPA or more likely an elder law attorney, and say, tell me about your priorities. And then they point out to them the alternatives. Look, it is possible that if you take some steps that we can save you a lot of money and still qualify you for Medicaid. There can be a lot of money that's saved for your loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's real important to you and you're willing to make these concessions, which need to be carefully described to them, then you charge forward with the plan. But I think that the door, that may be door number one, but we need to point out to them that there is at least a door number two.
If
not a three or four. But the door number two is to say, look, it does mean that with the amount of money you have, let's assume they're middle class, they may have $300,000 in assets, mm-hmm. $400,000, maybe $500,000 or more, less than $1 million. But they may be willing to live with some risk. It should be pointed out to them that it's not a given they're going to be for a lengthy time in a nursing home. Number one, they may never end up in long-term care.
Mm-hmm.
That is a statistical possibility. If not a probability, it's certainly a strong possibility.
And also with so many options today, there are a lot of options to help you stay in your home a little bit longer.
That's true. That's true. And that's a very good point.
We talked last time about whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, and cost may actually be more expensive to stay at home. But sometimes that transitional step is there, and you can have a little bit of assistance without breaking the bank.
And I want to come to your point, because your point is an important one in these considerations. So, you know, the attorney, I think, in due diligence should point out to the client there is the possibility you won't end up in there at all. Number two, there's a possibility that if you do end up in long-term care, whether this is a happy outcome or not, it may not be for very long.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be 3 months, 5 months, 6 months. So for you to make concessions or engage in transactions where you move the bulk of your wealth into a trust that has some rules and some access limitations, for you to do that and live with that, what may end up being, let's assume you're talking to your lawyer at age 70. So you end up going into a nursing home at age 90 and you're there for 3 months. So you've lived with these restrictions for these two decades.
Right.
And then at the end, what are you out? The cost of money for 3 months. And if you had a crystal ball, I think most people would say, well, forget that. I'll live with the risk. And when the time comes, I'll pay out of my pocket for the 3 months. 3 times $10,000, done.
Right.
And the rest, meanwhile, you had completely free of restriction. And then let's come to the point you just made, Susan. I mean, the idea that many people are really determined to stay at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's simply a fact. Published, anybody who picks up a book on aging, on seniors, on all these congressional and other governmental studies, you know, how do we cope with the needs of our aging population? They all are unanimous on one point, and that's
nobody wants to leave their home.
Well, people want to age in place, which means in their home. So there's unanimity on that.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever you start doing some planning for Medicaid, then it does mean that you are going to restrict your ability to do that, because by definition, you're placing your funds in vehicles and in places that might restrict, you know, it will restrict your free use of those funds. So oddly enough, if you're saying that it's so important for me to stay at home, I'm willing to spend everything I have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If that's your mentality, and if that's your situation with your children, then you probably don't want to do the Medicaid planning,
mm-hmm.
because it will prevent you from being in the position to being able to freely access your cash, to where you are going to spend it in a way that it's not going to be efficient. I mean, as we talked the last show, whenever you spend the money to be at home, it gets very expensive very fast, and you can easily end up spending the $10,000 a month to be at home. But if your priority is that you want to go out of this world that way, if it's a matter of dignity, it's a matter of autonomy, all those things are so important, then it's not consistent with your values to be able to do this sort of Medicaid planning, which wouldn't give you the money to do that because you've tied it up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably describing people who do not feel they have children that are dependent on that money. If we think about what is a common scenario, I concede, it is common for clients to be as, or quite frankly, more committed to assuring that their money goes to their kids than it is that they age in place.
Mm-hmm.
So when people have children who may be in those circumstances, or grandchildren, whatever the case may be, then, okay, we're back to it does make sense.
Right.
So I don't want to – one thing, Susan, I don't want to be guilty of is appearing to talk people out of doing Medicaid planning. I mean, we do Medicaid planning. So obviously, I'm not saying that I think Medicaid planning is bad. I don't. I think it's wonderful for our clients. But these are people who they've thought this through. And it's not good for everybody. Let me say that. When we have a client who doesn't fit this profile of somebody who has these priorities to preserve wealth, to not see it spent in this world for health care, who might have additional vulnerabilities. Remember, while it's true we don't have a crystal ball, we can have a pretty murky look into the future, at least when we have certain genetic predispositions. I mean, now they're doing these genomic readings, and they're being able to to identify genes that tell you something, not to mention you may know from the fate of family members.
Right.
So or you may have a diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So in any of those cases, suddenly it's not a matter of a shot in the dark, the probability that you're going to need long-term care. Then you may be in a position to better predict, yeah, it's going to be there. It's likely to be not a few months. It's likely to be a number of months. Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's is an example where it might be for an extensive period of time. So then you have to throw that into your hierarchy of priorities and say, you know, which is most important to me. But that's the sort of analysis that needs to go into the decision.
Well, and that's what a good elder law attorney will do. I mean, they're going to look and ask those questions that are going to be most important to you. If you want to travel, then a good elder law attorney, I think, is going to ask you, okay, let's make sure you can do that. Let's not put it all in such restrictive vehicles that you can't do the things that you want to do.
Yeah. And let me put a little flesh on that, because you raise a real world example where you want to do some things during your retirement that's going to take more than just the income that you earn. When I made reference, as I have the last couple of shows and in previous shows, whenever you're doing Medicaid planning, while there are a few techniques and several tools in the toolbox, so to speak, perhaps the most common vehicle is an irrevocable trust. And as the word irrevocable suggests, you put money in there, and the reason you can say persuasively to claimants, creditors, to the federal government, to CMS, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, et cetera, that you're broke when you have $500,000 in this trust, the reason that has credibility is because you are, in fact, restricted in your access. What you can get is the income. So whenever I'm doing plan with people, I want them to understand that, look, if we do this, if we can put money into an irrevocable trust now, $1 million, $10 million, whatever that number is, if you get through 60 months, if you get past the look-back period before you have to make application for the care, before you need the Medicare services, then you're good. You are going to qualify for Medicaid. Now you'll still have the income coming in. Mm-hmm. That's permissible. You can set up an irrevocable trust that allows you to have the income. That means if the money is in dividends, if it's in the form of interest, perhaps bonds, savings accounts, whatever it might be, it may be in the form of some sort of income from rental properties. But only the income would be available to you because you're going to disclose that income. So when you make application for Medicaid, you're going to say, yeah, I do have this income, and here's how much it is. And as long as that doesn't exceed the cost of the nursing home, then the shortfall is what you would get from CMS.
Okay.
Remember, Medicaid is bridging the gap. So if your income, whether it's through the trust or whether it's just your income from your pension as a school teacher, whatever it might be, if that is equal to the cost of your long-term care, then it's not that you're disqualified from Medicaid. It's that you don't need it.
Right.
It's defined as the shortfall. You know, you're required to contribute your income, and then when you're short, that's okay. So one effect would be that if you had too much income flowing out of this trust, then it would kind of make moot the situation of needing help from Medicaid. Most people aren't in that situation, particularly when we're in this incredibly low interest environment, mm-hmm. meaning that what you can reasonably invest those funds and draw 1% from them and find yourself, you know, getting a couple thousand dollars a year from a ton of money, from a large amount of money, so say $200,000 plus. So I think that people need to understand if they do this one vehicle, this commonly used method, then it does mean they can't reach in and grab that money to go do the travel or to go off and do something else that might be on their bucket list that mm-hmm. they've always wanted to do. That's utilizing the money for personal purposes. That's my dog, Scout. She's walking around the table as we're talking here.
Now she's laying down.
She's sitting down. She's right now. She had minor surgery on her paw, so she can't go out and run, and she's just getting cabin fever. Anyway, so... So that's a lifestyle question that people need to answer before they let any professional push them into Medicaid planning. Now, again, for some, it's a wonderful idea. Their attitude is, look, I have simple tastes. I don't spend the money I have coming in now. I can't tell you how often I hear that.
Mm-hmm.
People will express concern about, you know, giving up access to the principal on, say, $300,000 in savings or deferred assets, maybe 401k. And I'll ask them, I'll say, well, what's the income that you have now? They'll tell me, well, it's my required minimum distributions. It may be some interest I'm getting from other accounts. It could be a small pension. Let's assume it's $2,000, $3,000 a month. And I say, well, are you spending all of that every month? And they say, well, no, I probably spend about $2,000, $2,500.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they're living the relatively frugal, the conservative lifestyle that they've lived their entire lives.
Entire life, sure.
Yeah, so, and they don't feel like they're suffering. It'd be different if they're pinching nickels, you know, trying to save for retirement, saving. You think, well, look, the time's got to come where you've got to turn the spigot on a little more. This dripping is going to leave you going out of the world, you know, needlessly having made these sacrifices.
Mm-hmm.
But many people, they don't feel like they're pinching nickels. They're living a fulfilling lifestyle, and they're very comfortable with that, and they don't want more. So in that situation, if you have $300,000 or $400,000 or $500,000 sitting in the bank, if a lawyer says to you, well, yeah, if you think you may have a long-term care need, we can put this money in the trust. You can't get the principal. And that person, you know, would likely say, okay, I get that. I'm not troubled with that. But you mean I can have the income off of it? Yeah, you can. So for that person, it's a good idea.
Okay, so we had a question come in from a listener. And I'm wondering if the irrevocable trust might be a good option.
The aerobic trust.
The what?
We should call it the aerobic trust.
The aerobic trust.
The effort you have to go through to create one, but go ahead.
So it sounds like their goal is to help protect their savings. So they would like to know the best way that they can, they were saving for health expenses. You know, they wanted to have the money accessible for health
mm-hmm.
expenses, but they want to protect that in case they need to go into a nursing facility or something like that, and they still want to qualify for Medicaid. So is the best thing for them to put that into a trust?
Yeah, they could make the fund available. Does it say what state? Are they from Missouri?
From Missouri.
Mm-hmm. So if and not that the answer would necessarily be different in Illinois or Arkansas, but it could be. And so we'll focus on Missouri, which I know better, incidentally. So I think that in that case, if you go ahead and keep the money out, recognizing that it's going to be acknowledged by Medicaid, what you're in effect doing is making that money available for long-term care needs, expenses, because it'll be acknowledged. And you're allowed to do a spend down. So you can use the money, if you've set it aside for that purpose, you can use it for those early periods of care without making application for Medicaid. So it's actually not a bad idea. Here's what I mean to make this clear. Let's assume somebody has, let's assume that they have $300,000 and they want to save some of it. They want to protect it for purposes of Medicaid, but they want to have money out in the event that, well, what if I just need Medicaid for 2 months, mm-hmm. 3 months, 4 months, and then I don't have to invoke those Medicaid rules. Then what they'll do is they will choose some point in between. They will keep some portion of the money out, recognizing it'll be counted for Medicaid purposes, but the person is prepared to spend that, you know, in those early months, and it may be all they'll ever have to spend.
Mm-hmm.
So it's money that it gives them some discretion to have available funds, not only to use for healthcare, incidentally, but this person you're describing would be able to, by keeping this money out, could use it for anything. And still set aside a significant amount that they know will be safe. It's like taking a portion of your assets and putting them in a safe,
mm-hmm.
a safe that when you turn the combination, you know, you're not going to be able to access for certain things again, but you know it's there and it's safe for your loved ones
mm-hmm.
and maybe for your surviving spouse. And yet you keep out enough to where you know that I have in cash in the bank. I'll sleep better at night knowing that I can reach in and do anything I want with this money. And yes, it will be counted if you made application for Medicaid day one, but you don't make application day one. Meaning you if you ever decide to apply for Medicaid, which you may not, that
mm-hmm.
person may know or suspect that they're only going to be in a nursing home for a short period of time. But if they do, that's fine. They use this money first. So it's going to be spent. And then when it's spent, then they qualify for Medicaid.
So if you are ever in a situation, I've heard of people where they end up in a nursing facility, sometimes for rehabilitation, sometimes longer than what rehabilitation takes, but then they can come home. Does the clock start all over again? I mean, how does that work if they've qualified for Medicaid at one point and Medicaid's been making payments? Does it get really complicated if you're in and out? Because that's one of the questions we had, too. Somebody wanted to know if there was any downside to bringing a family member home from a nursing facility. They wanted to...
Wait, there's some, read the first part of the question again.
Is there any downside to bringing a Medicaid recipient home from a nursing home?
So they don't mention a state.
They don't. So it could be Illinois, could be Missouri. By the way, that's interesting to me that this is a federal program, or it seems like it anyway. And
it
there's
is.
So many different rules that vary state to state.
Yeah, yeah. And there's this thing called 209B states, which there are only, I think, six. And Missouri happens to be one of those. So Missouri, Illinois, I was looking at this recently to see the other states, Oklahoma. And so the 209B states are actually states who do have different rules from everybody else.
Oh, boy.
And and they're allowed to have different qualification rules, which in some ways is good. If that's the reason in Missouri, in a way you can say your income doesn't matter because at the risk of being redundant here, I like to make sure our audience understands that the way it works is even when you make a lot of money, it's not that you don't qualify for Medicaid based on income. It's that you don't need it. Mm-hmm. So it's different than an income cap state. The rest of the states are income cap states pretty much. And Missouri is one of those minority of states that's not an income cap state. It'll say, look, yeah, we'll give you whatever you need to pay for the cost of your nursing home after you've applied your income. So it's a very different definition. Mm-hmm. And 209B states are, in my opinion, preferable to practice in as an elder lawyer. But in this situation that you just described, I have to tell you that the law right now is very murky. Missouri launched into an effort beginning in 2008, two different programs. One was home and community-based waiver services. This is essentially health net for home.
Okay.
And whenever people hear the phrase health net in Missouri, that's simply the name of the Medicaid program in Missouri. So don't be confused if you hear people in the Division of Family Services or the Department of Senior and Disabled Services. If you hear them discussing things about health net, it's simply a way of saying that they're talking about Medicaid. So the program was, though, to have not only what's called vendor services, which means traditional Medicaid. I don't know where they come up with these phrases. It's called vendor.
It would be so much easier if they just said what they meant.
Yes, yes. So vendor services is referring to a traditional nursing home.
Okay.
And so there was this effort, though, to have these services used at home in the interest of saving taxpayers money, which makes a ton of sense. So let me make this clear when we talk about this, is that if you're considering getting Medicaid coverage at home, you still have to qualify for these three activities of daily living. We talked about the last show. I'm not going to go into it now, but this is simply the way that a healthcare professional determines that you need this custodial care or this institutional care associated with a nursing home. Well, you still have to meet that standard at home in order to have home and community-based coverage, in other words, Medicaid at home. In order to get that, you still need to demonstrate the need. And the whole idea from a taxpayer standpoint is, hey, let's go ahead and let this person have Medicaid pay for people to come in and maybe help them with their eating or prepare meals or help them transport them to and from the bed. In other words, those activities, not necessarily medical, but those activities that are being provided in a nursing home at much less cost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it gets to where the cost approaches that of a nursing home, then it's not in the taxpayer's interest, and this home-based Medicaid will not apply. So it only applies at the lower levels of care.
So now, is this home-based Medicaid what you see? Sometimes you'll see these commercials and these advertisements for your family member can earn up to so many dollars per hour for helping you stay at home in your own home with Medicaid and things like
that. Yeah,
that's exactly
what that's talking about. And it does. It can be a nephew or a grandson. and there's a specific amount that is authorized. Last I checked, it was $11 and some change per hour that would be authorized. Anybody but your spouse. Your spouse can't be paid to do that, which makes sense.
Right.
So now this is a program that was launched in Missouri in around 08. It is available, but now I have to tell you that the criteria for qualifying are a little different because it – I won't get into the woods on this. Just to say that income does become relevant in this program. Now, the good news is that the income of your spouse does not count. So your spouse's income is not relevant, only yours. But you, if your income is above – and the last I checked, the number was – it's going to seem a little low, but it's around $1,350 a month.
No, you're exactly right. I'm looking at a chart right now that is 2019. It says $1,348.
Good. Okay, $1,348. So the, it is a little bit of a different measurement, and I won't go into why that's true, but it's because of the different arrangements. One is at home, and you do have a spouse living there, so it kind of complicates the math versus the person going into a facility. Now, you can still,
but
though.
You know, the advantage of that is you don't have some stranger coming in.
You
which
don't.
Which is very important to so many seniors.
Oh, it's huge. And let me mention another technique. I don't want to fail to do this so that people listening can write this down. In Missouri, a number of attorneys have had success. And as we speak today, I know of no case, unless it's come down very recently, in which this has been overruled. And it's called a Miller Trust. A Miller Trust is a trust that has been approved by the court in which through the court you take your income and you place it in a trust. And then you can say, I don't have that income. And the IRS cannot, the Medicaid people, CMS, cannot accuse you of having made a impermissible transfer, an uncompensated transfer, because the money goes into this approved court-ordered trust. And a lawyer who practices in this area can help, will have to help you through it. It's not easy to do. But a Miller Trust has turned out to be a vehicle that, while it was commonly used in other states where income was a problem qualifying for Medicaid, as I mentioned a few moments ago, the majority of states are not 209B states. So they regularly resorted to these Miller Trusts. But in Missouri, they were never used because we didn't need them. Income wasn't a problem. It was just assets. Well, now we know that in order to qualify for Medicaid at home, it's a different standard, and income is relevant. So now you need a way to solve this problem that you may have $2,000 a month income or $2,500, and you want to qualify for this home Medicaid with a ceiling of $1,300. Well, you can do it by way of this Miller Trust. So I encourage people to take advantage of the possibility of qualifying for Medicaid at home, because if they do that and they're conscientious, as they should be for their care, especially managing chronic disease, which is the primary culprit for people ending up in long-term care, incidentally, is chronic disease.
Sure.
If they're more conscientious about managing these health needs and having people there to reduce the probability that they're going to fall and injure themselves, these are the things that can, oddly enough, prevent the taxpayer from ever paying for their long-term care in a nursing home and allow them to have a much more meaningful quality of life at home.
Well, sure, and if you're paying a family member $11 an hour to help you with some eating and some bathing and maybe medications and things like that, aren't you going to feel much more comfortable? It's going to save everybody money, it seems like to me, and you're helping out the family member who maybe, you know, it needs a little bit of extra help for their finances as well or something.
Yeah, yeah. Summarizing just real quickly, this is what's called the home and community-based waiver services. It's available to people whose income is at $1,300 a month max, just the recipient, spouse doesn't matter. But now remember, you can still get over that if your income is above it. And again, talk to a lawyer. Not everybody can do this. There are a number of factors that are involved in looking at your whole financial picture, et cetera. So go to a lawyer that practices in this area, probably an elder lawyer, and talk to them about this. But there are ways to perhaps still qualify, even if your income is above the $1,300 through the Miller Trust we mentioned. Now let me go to the question that this person sent in, which I think it wasn't just about starting out that way. I think I'm understanding her to be saying that she's been in a nursing home. She's qualified for Medicaid. Is this right?
Mm-hmm.
She qualified for Medicaid in the nursing home, and now she wants to keep it and go home. that may be more complicated in Missouri. So if this lady is in Missouri, that may be more complicated. Missouri started a pilot program, started in 08, and it was expanded in 2014 or so. And I have to tell you that it looked like the legislature was going to let it expire.
Okay.
And I haven't looked at it lately because I haven't had this issue come up in my practice. But it may be that it's no longer in effect. And what it was a program to do precisely that, to keep Medicaid in effect for people, to encourage people to move out of the nursing home back home.
Okay.
So it was intended to incentivize people who started out in the nursing home. Maybe they never should have,
mm-hmm.
If they knew there was an alternative. But this program, for reasons I don't know, I don't think it can be good fiscal planning.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't sound like it's good for the taxpayers to not continue the program. But the last I saw, it was going to expire in Missouri, and the legislature didn't appear they were going to do anything about it. But that was just for purposes of continuing the same coverage or similar coverage going from institutional care to home care. It doesn't mean that you can't independently qualify for home care, but it was a different...
Oh, okay. So yeah. You might have to just go through the process again to qualify.
I'm sure that there's nothing that... I haven't done this with a client, but I feel very confident that if you can qualify, move out of the institutional care, go home, qualify with the new standard, the new criteria, then I think you're fine. But this lady was hoping for a smoother transition, and that is what would have happened if Missouri had kept this program in place.
Okay, interesting. Maybe. All right, along those lines, though, we had another question come in. So, and I think this is very, very common, is that what do you do if your income is too high for Medicaid and too low for nursing home costs? Because there's a big, wide gap.
Yeah, there is. And, well, the good news is, and I kind of touched on this, actually. So, in a way, we can probably go through this very quickly. Two answers. If the woman is thinking about institutional care, is this a man or a woman?
It's a guy.
A guy. Mm-hmm. If the guy's thinking about institutional care, then the good news is if he's in Missouri, he's good. Or if he's in Illinois, he's good on the income piece. But he may be concerned that his assets are going to throw off too much income.
Right. I think they were looking at pension being too high. He had enough, some things coming in. And, you know, that's the catch-22, I think. You know, you spend your whole life trying to plan ahead and prepare and be a good mm-hmm. steward and take care of your family and have enough for retirement and have enough for all of these things. And yet sometimes you're still caught.
Yeah. And you can sometimes move assets around in a way to reduce income. Now, you have to be careful. I have to tell you that the eligibility specialists through the Division of Family Services, they're the ones who actually do the calculations to determine your qualifications. And and they're pretty fastidious about looking at your sources of income. And if they think that you have assets that are generating insufficient income, then they're allowed to impute to those assets a reasonable income. But the good news is the reasonable income is pretty low.
Hmm.
So sometimes people are throwing off a lot of income in ways that they can reduce it and still defend a claim again by the eligibility specialist that they should be generating income. And they say, well, yeah, use your tables and you'll see that I'm generating that amount of income, which is lower than they currently are. So some things you can adjust to reduce the flow of income. That's important.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, though, I think that you have to ask yourself, are you willing to take some of your assets and transfer them into a trust? And are you willing to have conditions of the trust to reduce income that's paid out to you? That is permissible to create a trust that way, to reduce your income eligibility.
But it's still a five-year look back?
It's still a five-year look back on the transfer.
Okay.
But now remember, for this person, they're worried about income being a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that tells me that either they don't like having to turn over the income that they are earning, whether it's, say, it's $2,000 or $3,000 a month, and even though they're going to get another $7,000, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
from Medicaid, and I would say that's looking a gift horse in the mouth, right?
Yeah.
But some people do that. I mean, I've had clients who, and I get it, they don't want to give any more than they have to, and if they have $5,000 a month income, they would prefer to keep the $5,000 and get the all the $10,000 cost from Medicaid. And I can tell you, those transactions are really scrutinized.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever you deliberately reduce your income. And so I'm real leery of a transaction like that because I think it's going to be red flagged. I think for the most part, you should be willing to pay the income that you have in exchange for getting the shortfall paid by Medicaid.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me. I mean, there really is no free lunch.
Yeah. And you know, if you're willing to take the chance, though, if you know you're going to need Medicaid, again, to emphasize a point, you can transfer all of your money into the trust and not have a provision for the trust to pay you income, just as you could gift it. And there's a 60-month look back, so it's not as if you can do that and turn around and make application immediately. You can't. There's a 60-month look back. But when you get to the 60th month, yeah, you don't have any of the income and the assets in the trust. That's a little scary because what if you never need Medicaid? And what if you never go into institutional care? You have no source of income and you've given up your assets.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like the greatest idea.
Most clients would not think that was a good plan.
All right, another question about Medicaid eligibility. So if my mother, we had someone write in, says my husband and I have cared for his mother for 2 years. Now she needs more extensive care, and so she's going to apply for Medicaid. Does the amount of income earned by my husband and me affect the Medicaid qualifications because she's been living with them for so long?
No, it doesn't.
I was going to say, I wouldn't think so at all, but.
No, that's the good news is that they've been paying for her support.
They have.
And so to the extent that she continued to live there, then of course that would be, you know, she'd be getting a gift of the equivalent of the rental value, but that doesn't create an asset. It's really effectively a source of income, so to speak. In this case, that's one of those occasions when you're not creating a problem for your loved one by helping them out. That's not always true.
Okay, what would be an example of when it would be?
Well, sometimes people will decide that they're going to transfer real estate, and they'll transfer real estate to a loved one, or they'll give them a life estate in real estate. Because they want to be sure their mom is taken care of. Anytime that you want to guarantee mom's financial security, and when you have a generation that's done much better than their parents, sometimes they'll want to go ahead and lock that down.
Mm-hmm.
So at the best of intentions, they create an asset that's going to be a bar to their obtaining, to the grand or to the parent or the grandparent obtaining the sort of care they'd otherwise qualify for. So as tempting as it is to transfer benefits and assets to loved ones, whether it's to your children or to your parents, you need to think about what is the impact going to have on them when it comes to certain government benefits that they might otherwise have been qualified for. You know, with kids, we often point out to parents, think about it before you simply hand them a check, because it means if you give it to your children, it means that their children, your grandchildren, will no longer qualify for all the scholarships and loans and grants that they might probably otherwise would have qualified for. There's a better way to transfer that money, and that better way is through a trust, where the trust has terms that can restrict the recipient's access. So it's the best of all worlds. You have a trustee who can choose to pay it out to mom or to a child or to a grandchild, but they can also choose to not pay it out. And that means that it, if it's written correctly, it won't work against them for any governmental benefit, whether it's Medicaid or whether it's grants or loans or scholarships for children.
So care is okay. Money is not.
Yeah. Before you do transfers like that, it's always good to run it through your attorney. How much time have we used?
We're out of time. We have about 30 seconds left.
Time flies. And I feel like there's so many things we didn't talk about on this topic. Well, we'll just make a point to circle back to Medicaid again in the next couple months, as I think has been kind of the schedule in which we occasionally follow. We know Medicaid is of importance to our listeners. Some, it's because they know they're going to need it. Others, because they suspect they might. So we promise you that we'll regularly circle back to this topic and discuss new developments, et cetera. So another episode of Elder Talk. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, providing smart solutions for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk with Joe Cordell, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.